So good evening. I'm Rabbi Mark Samath. Welcome to Pleasantville Community Synagogue, the lecture series that we are presenting through the good offices of our Adult Education Committee and our Israel Action Committee, working very closely together. And we thanked David and Ofli so much for making this possible. This is the second in a three-part series of lectures that we have the zchut, the merit of hearing. And I was asked by the chairs of the committees to make the introduction tonight. I'm going to make it very brief and simply to say that Dr. Sarah Tauber is a professor of Jewish education at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City. She did her graduate work in Jewish history in France and in the States. But more to the point, as I was telling the kids at dinner, when you get older and you go to college, this is the kind of teacher, whatever they're teaching, you take their course, okay? More than the credits is the teacher herself, one of the most brilliant and exciting teachers I've had the joy to study with, and it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Sarah Tauber.
Thank you, Rabbi Mark, for that very complimentary introduction. Hi, everybody. Glad to see you here. Those of you who are returning, glad to see you. Those of you who are coming for the first time, also glad to see you. I always like to start out with an introduction. Just let me know your name and if you belong to a synagogue or if you don't belong to a synagogue or wherever you live, just a very brief so that we all have a sense of who's here. Shall we start with you?
Sure. Peter Sanders and my wife, April.
Hi. I belong to the synagogue.
Bennett Solnick. I also belong here.
Peter Volges. I'm a member of the synagogue.
Karen Sanders. Likewise.
Audrey Lenoff, PCS.
Chris Martinez, PCS.
Joe Sachs, unaffiliated.
Terry Sachs, visitor.
David Felder, PCS.
Oldfrey Felder, PCS.
David Bernthal, PCS.
Itzik Min, CSI.
Marcy Gray, CSI and PCS.
Barbara
Doctor, Bookkeeper, PCS. Diane Trilling. Great. All right, so what we'll do tonight is I will speak, and then we will take a pause where you'll have a chance to refresh yourselves, and then we'll come back and have a discussion around the topic for tonight, which is the Hasidim versus the Misnagdim, or if you're going to be doing Sephardic pronunciation, we'll call it Mitnagdim. And what I wanted to start out with, first of all, is just a brief moment, a couple of things to get us going. The first is, I can't help but ignore the fact that yesterday there was a tragedy in the Jewish world with the killing of the three children and the one grown-up in France. And it made me think, if you may have seen the picture, by the way, of the man who was killed. I don't know if you saw it. He was wearing a Hasidic-looking garb, but he's not Hasidic, actually. He would be Misnagdic. We'll talk about that in a minute. And just to think, though, about two areas. One is the way in which internal schism and conflict in Jewish life and among Jews is part of the pressures of dealing with a external difficulties, and what happens when the external difficulties bear down upon the Jews, and how does that turn inward sometimes? That's something that I want you to keep in mind, because I think it plays a role in what we're going to be looking at. The second piece is, how do these schisms affect how Jews respond to the general travails of living, the issues of suffering and pain and loss and family discord, these things, and how does schism help us find solutions to those, oddly enough, and how does schism end up increasing the hostilities and tensions? So these are very big issues that kind of are, I think, run through some of the discussion that we're going to have tonight. So the Hasidim, briefly to say, we're going to go into a little more detail, were a group that exploded on the scene in 18th century Poland. And the people who fought them were called the Misnagdim, And that's from a Hebrew word, neged, against, because they were members of the more, what you would say, traditional Jewish elite, in fact, in Poland at this time period. And they felt that the Hasidim were a heretical sect who were going to tear apart the traditional Jewish life and the fabric of the community. And for about 30 years, they fought them in ways that, well, we might find shocking, or perhaps not so shocking. I do want to say that it's ironic that, and maybe even paradoxical, that what was once considered, and it's not so long ago, if you consider the span of Jewish history, we're talking only a few hundred years ago, that what was considered a radical and heretical sect, they were really called minim, they were, you will find out, minim means a sect in the negative context, namely the Hasidim, would today, in our lifetime, be viewed as the most extreme conservative upholders of classical Jewish tradition. So we're going to keep that in mind as we go forward. I also would just like to begin with a very brief story that may give some hint of the conflict that I'm about to describe and the implications. I have a colleague of mine who's a professor of modern Jewish history, and I ran into him in the hallway a couple of months ago, and I mentioned to him that I was going to be doing this series about the Hasidim and the Misnagdim as part of a larger series looking at the issues of schism in Jewish life and what they have meant and what they mean for us today. So my colleague David said, he said to me, I take my son who's 6 years old, I take him in a stroller every day, I walk him, this is in New York City, I walk him to school. And he likes me to tell him stories when I take him to school. So lately, and of course this you might find rather amusing, it's a professor of Jewish history, this is the kind of talk that goes on in certain places. He said, so lately I've been telling him stories about Jews who go to prison. And he really loves it. Said, today, it just so happened this morning that I decided to tell him about Jews who try to get other Jews into prison. And that really blew his mind. He couldn't believe that there were Jews who would be ratting on other Jews to send them to prison. And who was he talking about? He was talking about the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. Because in fact, they did that. They employed the powers of the Russian Tsar to imprison as a way of suppressing the leadership of the Hasidim in particular, and in fact they did have some success, which we'll look at in a moment. So first of all, I just want to go back to this definition of schism for everybody that I used last time that I think is helpful. I'll just read it to you, and if you weren't here, you'll hear it for the first time, and if you were here, you'll just get a little review. So schism can be defined as division, separation, discord, disharmony, or formal division or separation. It can be from a church or a religious body. It can be a condition of disagreement or a division of a group into two discordant groups. This definition can be applied to the dynamics of Jewish life at one time or another. And the question is, at which time did these divisions become so convulsive as to really threaten the fabric of Jewish life and Jewish community? And what can be learned from those convulsions that can help us understand not only Jewish history, but what's happening to us today? And there are really five major ways of thinking about schism in Jewish life. One of them is geographic schism, developing differently due to geographic circumstances. Another is sociological, the clashing strata within Jewish society, and that's something we're going to be looking at more carefully today. There's political schism, zealots, political causes, and their opponents. That will be less relevant to today's discussion from the past, but it carries over into relevance for today's discussion in the present, in the context of the state of Israel. And ideologically, questions about faith and reason, isolationist or accommodationist in people's approaches, Jews' approach. And then the fifth is spiritually, and this one is also going to be high on our list today, the issue of the authority of Torah, of the oral law, which laws, which traditions are considered valid, and what kinds of ritual and worship are legitimate, and what does that tell us about the state of Jewish religiosity and spirituality at any point in time. The other factor that I think is always important, and it's very important in this one to keep in mind, is that internal schism in Jewish history often has been precipitated by or enlarged upon by external factors and circumstances. And the Jews do not live in isolation from the larger society, even though sometimes we have imagined that we do, or at other times we would like to. So let's take, that being said, let's take a brief look at these two handouts that I gave you. One is a chronology, which we won't walk through the whole chronology because that could take the entire time we're here together. And then the other one is a map. And there are reasons why I included the map that's important. So we're taking a trip to Eastern Europe, to the kingdom of Poland, Lithuania, and then to the dismemberment of that kingdom into three different parts of the Prussian, Austrian, and Russian empires. And I must say that although this time period, starting in the mid-1700s, is much closer chronologically than what our last session was, which took place really at the turn of the era, at the beginning of 0, 100, and before that, in many ways tonight, you might feel that you are in a time that's much further away in one's imagination and your sense of being able to connect to the issues than the talk last time when we were 2,000 years chronologically. And I was thinking of a metaphor, which is a bit peculiar, but I think it might be helpful to you. Sometimes you may watch a sci-fi film and you'll say, that's really odd, that's really weird, but I recognize things that are happening in the science fiction movie. I think it's a little bit in the reverse. We're going to be going back to this Jewish world of Poland in the 1750s to about 1815. And you might, on the one hand, say, this seems very strange, very foreign. And yet, you might say, but there are things that I recognize. And of course, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, in fact, although they were not called that anymore, they were really called Lithuanian Jews, and their descendants are still around with us today. So they haven't disappeared. And so we need to also take that into consideration. All right, so with that in mind, the chronology is important simply because I'd like you to get a sense of how much upheaval and change was going on during the time period that we're going to be looking at. But also, so if you take a look, I started with the 11th to the 14th centuries. Jews lived in Poland for a very, very long time. And most of us who are Ashkenazi will trace our roots, regardless of whether we say we were Russian or Belarusian or Romanian, to that original medieval Polish kingdom, which was called, then, as of 1569, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So let's take a look, particularly, if you look where it says, the 15th and 16th centuries, the flourishing of Kabbalah. Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism, which is a esoteric, metaphysical, mysticism is complicated, we won't go into it, but it's really a discussion of the relationship of God and man, an intense desire for union, and man in the universe, God in the universe. So Kabbalah begins to really take off in deep ways in the 15th and 16th centuries following the expulsion of Spanish Jewry in Sfat, and that's going to be important. You see where it says the zenith of Polish Jewry? This is an incredible time for Jewish life in Poland, okay? It's a very varied, populated, flourishing community, in fact, okay? Jews are really spearheading the development of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth alongside of the nobility of Poland. To the extent that, for those of us who think that Jews didn't have any political activity until the establishment of the State of Israel, it's false. If you look at 1580 to 1764, there was actually a parliamentary style, almost a government within a government operating in Poland for the Jews called the Council of the Four Lands. It was supra-communal. It would meet several times a year in various fairs in Lublin and Yaroslav. And it had close relations with the Polish parliament, which was called a Republic of Nobles. So Jews were operating, they had 1% of the community. It was obviously very elite, but they were highly involved in a essentially parliamentary style government within the larger government of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So that's another piece. And that went on for quite a while. 1648 to 1649, just I did not highlight it, there were the Ukrainian Cossacks under Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who this is important. He was really hostile to the Poles, but he saw the Jews as the front line of the Polish nobility. And in trying to establish his independence for the Ukrainian Cossacks, they slaughtered probably about 220,000 Jews, which may at that time have been about 10% of the Jewish population of Poland. So we're talking about a massive slaughter. And Jews, though, they regrouped. Remarkably, the historians feel they regrouped actually fairly well. But let's not forget, if you lose 10% of the population, that's huge. And the what happens as a result of the other things, you may not have lost your life, but your home, your families, your livelihood, etc. Another key moment. For those of you who are familiar with Jewish history, you may have heard of Shabtai Tzvi. He was an Ottoman. He was from the Ottoman Empire. And he studied Kabbalah, and in 1665 to 1666, with his PR man, Nathan of Gaza, claims that he's the Messiah, and people believe him. There's a need to believe in a Messiah, and it spreads all over the Jewish world. It hits Poland. It hits everywhere. And then he's discovered that he's not the Messiah, and he converts to Islam, although secretly he may have still been practicing Jewish ritual. And this is devastating. And there are people, though, who, including important rabbis, who refuse to believe that he was not the Messiah, and they go underground. And this is going to be a factor in Hasidism as well. Okay, so there are secret groups practicing basically that the Messiah has come. All right. We then have the birth of some important characters. Then there are another series of uprisings from Ukrainian Greek Orthodox in the middle of the 1700s. And they're attacking not only Jews, also Poles, but they terrorize the local population, and there are some pretty bad, violent episodes. Beginning in the 1730s, this is where you have the founder of Hasidism, Israel ben Eliezer, known as the Baal Shem Tov, and we'll discuss him in a second, who begins to spread a message of what you might call Kabbalah for the masses. Okay? And now we'll take a look at the map briefly. If you look at the map, this is a map of Poland that actually shows the partitions of Poland in 1772, 93, and 95. This was the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But Hasidism begins in the region, if you look to the right, called Podolia and Volhynia. All right? It's really in the Ukraine. And it was a center of Jewish colonization where there was much less Torah scholarship and Torah learning. Okay, that's an important piece of this. Okay, and it's the Hasids are not considered Torah scholars. On the contrary, we'll take a look at that. Okay, and from there it moves rapidly to the west, heading into Galicia, you'll see, and then into center Poland, and then it also moves north towards Lithuania, which is where it meets the opposition. Lithuania was a heartland of scholarship and Torah learning, and it's there, especially Vilna, where it hits opposition from the leadership of the communities in Lithuania, and they take a stand against the Hasids, and we'll talk about that. So it's all within that general area. Let's go to the back, please, quickly. And you'll just take a look to see there was another false messiah, a Polish Jew. It's on the back, called Jacob Frank. And so he was from Poland. And so again, this feeling of a Messiah, when's the Messiah going to come? When are our troubles going to be solved? When are our problems going to be over? And he disappoints as well, and he converts to Catholicism. And this really freaks out, so to speak, the rabbinic leadership. So in the short span of less than 100 years, you have two Jews just saying that they're the Messiah, and two Jews then abdicating and converting. Okay? By the 1760s, approximately one-third of the world's Jews live in Poland, Lithuania. We'll take a look at the 1772, 1774, 1781, and 1797. You should be aware that in this fight against this upsurging movement, there are communal bans. It gets so serious, a ban called a cherem in Hebrew, on Hasidism, issued by the foremost opponent, Elijah of Vilna, known as the Vilna Gaon, and we'll talk about him. And what do they declare? You should burn Hasidic writings publicly. You should not be permitted to worship in Hasidic prayer houses. You should not intermarry with anybody who's a Hasid. You should not be buried in the same cemeteries with anybody who's a Hasid. You should not do business with them, and you should not eat their meat. So very strong, and this went on for a good 30 years. And the Hasids return with reciprocal bans, and there's an intensification. During this time period, the Polish Commonwealth is dismembered. So now you don't have Polish Jews anymore. You have the beginning of Eastern European Jewry, and these Jews that had all been sort of centered in this one really country now are split up. And how does that affect their movement? And then finally, if you look by 1800 to 1815, a large percentage of Eastern European Jewry have become followers of the Hasidic Rebbes. There's a diversification in their leadership and attitudes among Hasidic leaders. And by the 1830s, so we're talking about under less than 100 years, they move from being a persecuted group to becoming really the way of life, the leadership structure of the majority of Jews in the Ukraine, in Galicia and central Poland, as well as having a large following in Belarus, Lithuania, and Hungary. So how did this happen? What happened? So we're going to take a look at this in three ways. First, we're going to look at the emergence of Hasidism as a splinter group, how it challenged the normative Judaism of its time in Poland, and what were the major sources of the conflict, and then what are the themes that we can take away that might be relevant to our era, okay? So first of all, let's get clear about this term Hasidism. Hasidism comes from the term Chasid. Chasid normally is translated as piety, and so you can trace it really to the books of the Maccabees. There were groups called Chassids. These are Jews who are considered intensely pious. They go above and beyond the call of Jewish religion and Jewish religiosity, but they take different forms throughout different eras. So in the early Middle Ages, there were also Chassids in Germany. This group of Chassids call themselves as such because they are pious, but we're going to look at in different ways. Their opponents accuse them of being far from pious, of being heretical. So we'll take a look at it. Now, the emergence of Chassidism takes place in the backdrop of all of these upheavals that I was just talking to you about. All right, the upheavals of the breakup of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. The upheavals of the periodic and episodic attacks on Jews that were that every time you had to regroup and figure out what was going on. The Council of Four Lands was broken up deliberately in 1764. So this unifying sort of governmental system also broke things up. So Jews were dealing with the external pressures and the internal pressures that were bearing down upon them in this part of the world. All right. There also was, because of some of these pressures, there was a noticeable decline of learning. People weren't able to focus as much except for the elite, all right? Ignorance was really on the upswing. There was a lot of superstition that was around. And in fact, Polish documents, interestingly, point to growing incidents of conversion during this time period of Jews. So we think that the Jews of Poland never left the fold. It's not true. So that's another piece. Whenever you see fair numbers of Jews leaving, it's something you have to ask yourself, what's going on? All right? So you have Jewish leadership. The framework was shaken. Their authority was shaken. The methods that they used were shaken. And there was a spiritual fragility and tension because the Shabbatai Tzvi and Jacob Frank false messiahs, that had not been resolved. People weren't really sure what kind of a time period were we living in. So you might say to yourself, and I hope you would say to yourself, so what was the response of the leadership? In particular, there weren't only rabbis as leaders, there were communal leaders, but we're going to take a look now at the leadership of the rabbis because this is going to be a driving force in the conflict. Rabbis drive the opposition to Hasidism, okay? So what did they do? Before you have Hasidism emerge even, what was going on? In light of the tensions facing the Polish Jews, you had retrenchment. In fact, they turned inward. They were neglecting the masses. They were very focused on what I would call an intellectualism rather than a true study of Torah in order to enhance one's life. There's something very famous called Pilpul, which is sort of Talmudic dialectics. And there was this elite group of scholars. Learning was reserved for them. There were sermons where the rabbis, when they did give sermons, they were hellfire and brimstone sermons. They were talking to people about devils and demons and sinning. And there were wandering preachers called Magidim, who would go around also telling people that their sins were due to their faults and their flaws, and this is why we're suffering, this is why troubles are coming upon us. So there was a lot of fear, and there was a lot of asceticism, and quite a bit of sort of strictness and melancholy in Jewish culture leading up to the emergence of Hasidism. Now, balancing that was this way that Kabbalah, really kind of coming out of the Sabbatean Messianic movement, was percolating in Eastern Europe. It had reached the masses. There was this idea kind of mystical ecstasy, union and communion with God, mass enthusiasm. There were groups of mystics who were gathering together. By the way, Pietism was also at this time developing in Ukraine, where Hasidism emerges. You had pietistic groups of Ukrainian Greek Catholics. So there were these groups that were looking for other ways to find spiritual sustenance, for other ways of organizing their Jewish lives that were percolating in the communities. And in some ways, they were seen as threats to the established communal norms because they were doing things that were outside of what was considered the customary bounds. For example, their prayer rites often were using Sephardic, what we call Isaac Luria, who is one of the famous Kabbalists. They were using different prayer rites. Their structure was not based around families. It was based around prayer circles. So these are all the seeds out of which the Hasidic movement is really going to come. Now, combined with that, you had a sort of authoritarianism that was existence among the rabbis. So Jews were accustomed to authoritarian leader figures. Of course, it was the time period as well. But when these authoritarian leaders are not reaching the people, they're still waiting for some other kind of leadership to emerge. And that's really one of the things that was happening. Okay, so out of all of this ferment comes a new way of approaching Jewish spirituality, Jewish communal organization, and Jewish leadership. And it challenges the traditional Jewish structures of the community. So there are three ways that we're going to explore. One way is looking at the notion of the Rebbe, also called a tzaddik, versus the rabbi. And that's very important to think about models of leadership. Because the Hasids, as a movement, develops into a movement, they provide a competitive leadership model. And we'll take a look at that. And it's important for us to think about that in today's world. Who represents our religious leadership? And you could take it even further, and we will in a second, what other kinds of leadership are existing that provide Jews with a sense of coherence and relevance and meaning in relationship to the religious tradition? That's one piece. The other thing we're going to look at is this notion of intellect versus affect. Because the Hasidim really challenge the primacy of what I call intellectualism of the time. They say that there's another model, that Torah study is not necessarily the primary religious value. And we'll take a look at that, why that was so threatening especially to the religious leadership of the time. And then the third piece we're going to look at is something that I don't think is explored so much, but I think is very important, and I'm going to call it law versus lore, or what we would call halacha, Jewish law, versus narrative, what's also known as halacha and agada, if you're thinking in a more traditional Jewish way. And why is that important? Figuring out what does it mean to live a Jewish life? And the notion that Jewish law is the determining factor versus a Jewish narrative and feeling part of a Jewish story is key to Jewish life. So we're going to be, those are the three we're going to look at, and then we'll pull it back and see more broad questions that arise from it. All right, so first thing is the Rebbe. All right, so I'm going to start with the Hasidic leadership, because then you'll see what the Misnagdim, what they didn't like about it. All right, I'm not going to start with the ones who are the origin. So the way I'm going to do this to kind of coalesce is to show you a little bit about the two very visible figures. One is Israel ben Eliezer, who was called the Baal Shem Tov. We'll talk about what that means in a minute, or the Besht, that's for short. He was called the Besht. And the rabbi is
is the Vilna Gaon, and we'll talk about that in a minute, him in a minute too. All right, so the Baal Shem Tov is a legendary character. There's a historical Baal Shem Tov, and there's a mythological Baal Shem Tov, and historians are always trying to figure out, or are interested in trying to figure out where there's overlap and where there's just difference, okay? And he's sort of the prototype of the Rebbe, or the tzaddik. Tzaddik considered the righteous, just person. That's what they are called as well. He was born in 1700 approximately and died in 1760. So what's this thing Baal Shem? Baal Shem is literally translated as sort of master of the name. Really what Baal Shem means is I'm going to say it like a magician, but not a magician in the terms of an entertainer magician. They were seen as sort of shaman-like magical healers that could use prayer and meditation and herbs and other things to connect with the divine, and through that they would help people to heal physically, heal spiritually, heal emotionally. Now, the Baal Shem, this one, Israel Baal Shem, was not the only one. In fact, at this time period, there were a lot of these Baal Shem wandering around the countryside. Jews clearly felt need. And by the way, they were not only Baal Shem Jewish ones, there were also non-Jewish ones. And Israel Baal Shem Tov was known by non-Jews also as sort of a super Baal Shem. All right, he was considered really very powerful. And he probably had a group of followers around him who were pietists, who spent their time, some of them being very ascetic, though he was opposed to that, and reaching out and healing and praying. But he was also integrated into the community where he lived. He was not an outsider. He did not try to challenge in an aggressive way the rabbis. But something, and we'll talk about what he was doing, was different. He was originally sort of seen, if you might call it, as we have resident scholars, he was the resident Kabbalist in his town, all right? And he was recognized by the local authorities. He didn't try to rebel. He wasn't trying initially to undermine the leadership of the community, but he had some different ways of understanding Jewish life and Jewish religion. And this is what distinguished him from other Baal Shem and what distinguished him from the rabbis. First of all, he felt that the social conditions of the Jews, the way, the plight, what they were dealing with socially, economically, spiritually, needed compassion. And so he adopted an attitude that you have to reach out to the masses in a compassionate way, including charity, including listening to them and hearing them, rather than condemn them. And this distinguished him from the rabbis. He was seen as a solace figure, so to speak, in addition to his notion of his being sort of a healer. All right, that was one piece of him. The other thing is that he took on as a Baal Shem, he took on not only people's individual troubles, but he addressed the collective troubles of the Jewish people. He addressed the massacres. There were blood libels. He addressed plagues. And he tried to work with them to figure out ways to solve them. That's another piece, okay? Another thing has to do with the way that he felt about prayer. He felt that prayer was not to be an ascetic kind of prayer. He wanted people to find joy through prayer, and that through prayer you could find what the mystics call devkut, which is called communion with God, that it was a way that you could get close to God. This distinguished him really from the rabbis, who had a very pessimistic view of the regular Jew. They felt that regular Jews couldn't do that. They couldn't approach God. They should daven because that's what the law required, and it's all male, of course. But this notion that through prayer you could have a close relationship with a God who cares about you was, at this time, very radical. Which goes to show you a little bit about the spirituality of the people at this time. The other piece was that the Rebbe, or the Tzaddik, was really a conduit. And this is another piece. You could have direct experiences with God, but the Rebbe was there to help you. The Rebbe would help you raise your spirit to God and help you to bring God down to you.
So there was this notion, and it may sound very peculiar. Doesn't this sound like a priest? It does sound a little bit like a priest, but the tzaddik doesn't do sacraments or anything like that. But there's this notion that there's an intermediary who cares deeply about you as a regular person and who has some special connection with the divine. And this, at the time period, was incredibly compelling. The other piece was this notion that you could come to me with your problems, the idea of a moral confessor, that you didn't just go to ask me if the chicken's kosher or not. You went to talk to me about, why can't I believe in God, even in this time period? Why can't my wife have children? And that the Rebbe was there to help you to solve those very personal, emotional, and psychological issues. So these are some pieces that really distinguish the Hasid, and this was very threatening to the rabbinic establishment. And let you explain why. Okay, so Israel, the Baal Shem Tov, had this magnetic, charismatic personality that could reach the masses. This couldn't have been more far from the image of the rabbi at the time, who would be embodied by Eliezer ben Shlomo, called the Vilna Gaon. And Gaon here is a term really that means genius, okay? And he lived in Vilna, though he was not originally born in Vilna. He was born about 1720, and he becomes the representative of the Misnagdim, the strongest opponent of the Hasidim. So let's look at him to try to get some picture of the ideal rabbi of the time, although he actually was in some ways a little bit different than the ideal rabbis, and he sets the stage also for the emergence of a new kind of rabbi, which has very important implications for today. I'll talk about it in a second. So he was born into a rabbinical and scholarly family. Very important. He had what we call in Yiddish, yichus. And at this time period in Jewish life, there were three qualities that made you in the traditional Jewish world of Poland that made you able to have a position of importance in the rabbinic elite. One was your scholarship. Okay, how well could you study the Talmudic codes and know them? And he was absolutely amazing. The other thing was family connections. Was your family? Did your family have repute? And the third piece was, did you have money, wealth? Those were the three qualities. And of course, the Hasidim and the Rebbes completely in the first few generations challenged that entirely. They don't have any of those. They're like newcomers in a way on the scene. Okay, so the Vilna Gaon was considered a brilliant Talmudic scholar. But curiously, he didn't study with other people. He studied alone. He was definitely a loner. He also never held a formal communal post as a rabbi. And this is very important because he's going to set the stage that to really be considered a Talmudic scholar, a Talmud Chacham, you don't want to be a communal rabbi. You want to be spending all your time studying. So he at this point in time, there's a little bit of a shift going on. And he never held a formal post, but he was seen as the de facto head of the Vilna and Lithuanian Jewry because of his range of learning. Beyond that, though, he had other learning, which I think is important. He studied mathematics and science, but he did not study it in order to open up himself or the other Jews to the larger world of Jewish enlightenment that was also coming in at this time period. Really, it was for the sake of understanding halakha. How do we understand Jewish law? By studying math, by studying astronomy. He had no idea about Newton, by the way. So it was very much earlier understanding. He studied it from the Arabic, the translations via Arab science. But he was considered an intellectual giant. And he had a very strong sense of the importance of hierarchy, the spiritual and communal hierarchy of Jewish life, with rabbis at the top of that, okay? And that the study represented the highest form of worship. And we'll talk about that in a second when we get to this notion of intellect versus affect. The Vilna Gaon was very concerned that the Hasids in those first few generations were denigrating the value of Torah study. And guess what? He was right. They were, to some extent, saying that the kind of Torah study that's going on is not what we think is really Torah. They did end up challenging that. That was one piece. The other thing that got him very revved up was that the Hasids were, in their manner, the Rebbes and their followers, that they were disrespecting the Torah scholars. They were disrespecting the rabbis, whether they did it explicitly, and some of them did, by the way, or implicitly by presenting another model, that this was undermining the communal structure and that they were creating separation. They were segmenting the Jewish community. And he saw this as a threat. So that's another piece. However, the most important thing about him, in some ways, was his terror that the Hasids were really a reincarnation of the Sabbatean movement, these messianic movements, that they represented the bubbling up of these underground heretical movements, and that the notion that the Messiah had come and was here on earth was incredibly threatening. And so he felt that the Hasids, that they needed to be crushed. Now, the Hasids never said that. They never said that they were representing the notions of messianic times. However, because the way they brought Kabbalah into the masses and because of the relationship of Kabbalah to the Messiah, especially Shabbatai Tzvi, there was this feeling. In addition to which, the region from which Hasidism emerges, this Podolia and Volhynia, there were cells of secret Sabbateans. So the Vilna Gaon was not whacked out in worrying about the threat, and in fact, he turned out to be quite correct, okay, that the Hasids represented to the larger structure of communal life. The problem was that he didn't have an answer that could help the masses figure out how to live Jewishly in this time of great transition and upheaval and change. There was this retrenchment. And in fact, interestingly enough, the Lithuanian Misnagdim, part of their response to the Hasids, and we'll talk about this in a second, was that they began to set up supra-communal organizations called their yeshivot, but not yeshivot that are located in local communities. They're yeshivot where Jewish men can go, come from one region to study, especially the Lithuanian yeshivas. And this is the beginnings of this idea that all a Talmud Chacham does is study. It starts here in response partially to the Hasids, and then later it's going to build up in response to the secularization of Jewish life. So this, the idea where you see in Israel that the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi, spend all their time studying, this does not go back to the Talmud. This really only goes back till about the 1800s. It's in the span of Jewish history. It's short, if you think about that, okay? Previous to this time, and even throughout this time, most scholars, rabbinic rabbis, they held jobs, whether they were communal rabbis or they had other things. They were not completely turned inward, and all that they had to do was study. So we're going to keep those common things in mind. All right, the next topic that we're going to move to is this notion of intellect versus affect. And I'm going to spend a little bit less time because some of it I've already talked about it. So picking up with Elijah, the Vilna of Gaon, for the leadership of this era, the kind of culture of this era, study was considered the highest good, the highest way to express your love of God, your faith in God. The problem was that the kind of study that was going on did not answer questions that people had about their lives. It became a kind of competitive game for the elite, rather than a response that study helps us figure out how we're supposed to deal with sickness, how we're supposed to deal with earning a livelihood, how we're supposed to deal with pride. And it was a flaw in the approach, but the Misnagdim couldn't get outside of it. They couldn't let go of this idea that this was study. And this partially had to do with the fact that they had a very pessimistic view of human capacities and of the capacity of the regular Jew. It was not a hopeful image of humankind. And so, in a way, they secluded themselves. So, moving on to why was Hasidism such a threat to this kind of approach? Because they say that Torah and Judaism is really about connecting with God. In fact, They were considered heretical because they said that God was in every place and could be served through everything. Now, this is not pantheism. This is what is called often panentheism. And I'm not going to go into the minutiae of that, but this nice notion, as Martin Buber said, to love the world in God. This was central to Hasidism, and this was seen literally as heretical. This was an absolutely theologically a concept that the Misnagdim could not tolerate. They could not tolerate that regular Jews would be exploring these esoteric concepts. What the Chassids were doing was taking these very complicated mystical concepts and bringing them down into the life of regular people. So, for example, they would say, all was to be hallowed. Everything that we do can be hallowed. This notion of repairing the world through hallowing material life. And they had a concept called avodah begashmiut, serving God through the corporal world. So, bodily acts, eating, business, sex, you turn your natural desires into a vehicle for the worship of God. Now, this could become extreme, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, what happens. So that's one piece. This was absolutely unacceptable to the rabbinic leadership, okay, of the time. Another piece was prayer. For, as I mentioned before, prayer here was not just an act of fulfilling an obligation. It had to be done with intention, what's called kavanah. So, for example, the Chassids would sometimes spend hours preparing for prayer and go over the limits that had been set. And this drove the rabbinic leadership crazy because they felt that they were taking apart the structures that kept Jewish life orderly. They were dismantling them. They also felt that they were acting out certain fantasies. There would be, in fact, at the beginning, the Chassids would be somersaulting. They would call out. They would scream. It was ecstatic. And to the rabbinic leadership, this was seen as completely threatening and undermining a certain vision of what prayer was about and what Jewish life ought to be about. The notion that you pray through joy, this was also seen as, I have to say, heretical. Okay? So there is a shift by the Chassids that you observe with intention, you observe the commandments with joy. And the Misnagdim said, that's not what you do. You observe because you've been commanded to do so. This didn't jive for a lot of Jews at the time period. And the final thing when we get to intellect versus affect that I think is really important is that Chassid sent a message, and we talk about self-hatred of minorities. They said, you know, just rejoice that you're a Jew. If you can't do other things, just be grateful that you're a Jew. And they found ways to help them to do that. If you're thinking of a time when Jews are converting, when they're experiencing extreme pressure and tension, the notion that you can be glad to be a Jew is actually in some ways brilliant. So that wasn't very important. So we'll move on to the last category, and then we'll kind of pull it back, which is this notion of law versus lore, or halakha, traditional Jewish law, versus agadah, or narrative or story. So in this time period leading up to the emergence of the Hasidim and then following, the conventional Jewish take was the quality of your Jewishness was measured solely by observance. But this kind of observance was not the observance that we see in the Talmud, where there are various discussions, where there's a possibility to be more strict about the interpretation of the law or more lenient about the interpretation of the law. The attitude of the Polish rabbinic establishment of the time was that the piety of each generation was demonstrated by adding restriction upon restriction, what's called chumrah or chomer, okay? And effectively what they did was that only really learned people could figure out the intricacies of all this observance. So many regular Jews felt very disconnected on the one hand from the importance of piety. And yet at the other hand, they were expected to be fulfilling all of these laws, and there was a lot of watching what you were doing and monitoring of your behavior. And so one of the questions that the Chassids raise is external obedience to the law, the only thing that matters if you're a Jew. And Chassids don't say observance doesn't matter. It matters. They were observant. Let's not pretend that they were going out and eating pork and doing other things. They weren't doing that. But they shift the equation, okay? They say, in fact, an over-focus on all of this observance contributes to this notion of melancholy, what they felt was very damaging to the spirit of Judaism, and they felt that it was a spiritual malaise that had taken hold of Jewry. They called it in Hebrew atzvut, and that increased the fear and the despair of the regular Jew. So what did they come with response? If they weren't going to reject Jewish law, even though the Misnagdim maintained that in the areas of prayer and in the areas of Jewish slaughter and in the area of Torah study, they were being heretical. They really, in many ways, were not. They were doing things differently, but if you stand back from time, we see that they weren't breaking law, so to speak. They came up with a competitive model to halakha, which was the famous Hasidic story. And I really think this is something for our generation to consider as well, not because we're all super observant of the mitzvot, so to speak, in a traditional way, but because, like the Jews of that time, we were in search of some kind of meaning that made our Jewish existence cohere in a time of incoherence. In our time, I believe personally that the shaking up modernity and then the Holocaust, we often have a very incoherent narrative. How does what it means to be a Jew hang together? And the Hasids picked up that was something that was happening in their time period as well. So let's take a look at this Hasidic story, okay? It's an alternative to the legalistic literature. These are tales that first develop around Israel Baal Shem Tov. He starts telling the tales. He never wrote anything, but his followers, the next generation, you would say, they take these tales and they begin to record them and pass them on. There would also be special times, especially Saturday nights after Shabbat, when the Hasidic Rebbes would gather their followers around the tish, the table, and they would tell stories, okay? So before this time period, if you can imagine, the rabbinic leadership looked very down on tale-telling. They felt it was a waste of time. It was frowned upon. Okay? So the Hasids are saying, no, this is actually worthwhile. And one of the reasons it's worthwhile is that we can awaken God's immanent spirit through the telling of a tale. That the tale has a spiritual power in and of itself, and you can communicate basic religious and spiritual ideas through it, and you communicate the stories of the people, the human beings, especially the Rebbes, okay, who were living at that time and then who follow, okay? And in fact, people who study Hasidism believe that more important than their philosophy, which they sketched out and we'll take a look at, were the stories. That the stories become a kind of religious act that have importance as much as the mitzvot, as much as study, and as much as prayer. Okay? And one of the reasons why these stories were so important was that anybody could tell them. You had a woman could tell the story, a child could tell the story. So here what you have is something very threatening to an elite, which is a democratization of the narrative. It's not just the rabbi who gets to control what the story is. It's anybody who can hear the story, and then it gets translated and transformed over time into things that may not mean initially what it meant, but that have a kind of a transformative value. And I just briefly, we're reaching the end, I just briefly want to read to you two like very excerpts. There was a story, this is supposedly told by the Beisht, about what happened to Jewish life. Why did it seem to get so empty? And here's the story that was related. An apprentice blacksmith, after he had learned his trade from the master, made a list for himself of how he must go about his craft, how he should pump the bellows, secure the anvil, and wield the hammer. He omitted nothing. When he went to work at the king's palace, however, he discovered to his dismay that he could not perform his duties and was dismissed. He had forgotten to note one thing, perhaps because it was so obvious, that first he must ignite a spark to kindle the fire. He had to return to his master, who reminded him of the first principle which he had forgotten. So they took this story, and then it was transformed into all sorts of meanings. The next one is the issue of God's remoteness. How do we deal with God's remoteness? And this is, I think, quite fascinating. Once a king built a magnificent palace for himself with many rooms, walls, and corridors. He himself decided to reside in the innermost chamber. When the palace was finished, however, his servants, who wanted to pay their respects, found that they were unable to reach the king because of the labyrinthine maze within which they lost their way. As they pondered the problem, the king's son arrived and went directly to the king. He showed the others that the walls were no walls at all, only human illusions, and that the king was easily accessible to him who could push forward bravely. So that notion that where is God? God is wherever you let God in. This was one of their stories that they told. And there are many of them, and Martin Buber, of course, is very famous in that he took these Hasidic stories and he refashioned them using his own language. But there are many, many of them. And in fact, interestingly enough, the most recent Hasidic stories, there's a book collection called Hasidic Stories of the Holocaust, which may be considered the first book Hasidic collection of stories since the 1700s and 1800s. And you might want to take a look at it. So we're going to take a break in a minute. And there are a few points that I want to consider. First of all, in our next session, we're going to be looking at the political explosion in Jewish life and the schisms that it created. But I want you to be aware of a few things. First of all, most Hasids and most Misnagids obviously were exterminated during World War II. Those leaders who managed to escape and their followers have regrouped in Israel, most and primarily, and in the United States. But there's one group that I think we need to pay a little bit of attention to, because I wonder whether some of the fears of Elijah, the Vilna Gaon, were not totally unfounded. All right, and that's Chabad. All right, now Chabad was the Hasidic sect that was founded more in Lithuania. It was more intellectual. Chabad is an acronym for wisdom, insight, and knowledge. And it was therefore more inclined towards Torah study as well. And its founder, Schnur Zalman Liadi, the Schneerson family, comes from the word Schnur, which probably means senor. They were probably of Sephardic origin. All right. The Chabad group, also known as Lubavitch, is now in some ways the face of Hasidism because they've been very successful. In fact, what you should know is that most other Hasidic groups have written off Chabad as completely non-Hasidic at this point. And in fact, the leader of what is still considered the Lithuanian Jews in Israel, when asked a while back, which religion do you think is closest to Judaism? He answered, maybe Chabad. And this is not funny, because why? Because of the issue that Chabad has essentially, a group of Chabad has maintained that Menachem Schneerson is the Messiah. And they believe that. And it's rather shocking in many ways, which we can discuss after, why this hasn't aroused more protests. This is the group that has the most successful outreach to the world of non-Orthodox Judaism. And we have to consider the implications of that. The other piece of this Chabad movement, which I think is fascinating, and with that I'll pose the four closing points and questions, is that when the Soviet Union was created, the Hasidic movement was outlawed in the Soviet Union. The Chabad sect, the Chabad group, went underground. And they had observed, though, how Bolshevik communism had also been an illegal underground movement. And the father-in-law of the one who died, who is considered the Messiah, he was imprisoned by the Soviets. And there are some theories, including my colleague, who believe that one of the reasons for the success of Chabad is because the father-in-law of Menachem Schneerson really followed and observed the way that the Bolsheviks operated in the Soviet Union, that they saw themselves as an army, that they were highly centralized, that they created underground cells, and that when he came to the United States, he reformatted a lot of Chabad on the model of the Bolshevik plan. And so it's quite fascinating. On the one hand, you have this notion of messianism among
in traditional Jews, and then the notion of Bolshevism, which also had messianic overtones, that the world is going to be saved. So let's close. What happened? How did the Hasids win? Because they indeed, in many ways, did win. First of all, they simply outnumbered their opponents. Their way of life took over in Jewish communities. They also, by the third generation, had really modified some of their more radical tendencies and had created a closer approximation, Torah study, and those kinds of things. After the Vilna Gaon died, the Misnagid leaders modified some of their harsh criticism. And then finally, and this also brings us up to today, the Jewish Enlightenment, the secularizing tendencies called the Haskalah, are perceived by both groups as a much greater threat to Jewish integrity and to Jewish life than either of their particular visions. And so they join together to fight the encroaching secularism. So let's break and then come back. There are a couple of questions. One is, who gets to set the agenda for what Judaism is and what it becomes? That's something I think we ought to ask ourselves as we look at the history. Second, what gives religious leadership legitimacy? How do we determine who is a legitimate religious leader? How do we create communal cohesion? And how does schism undermine that? And then the final question is, what is Jewish religiosity and Jewish spirituality? And how do we define it and understand it for our time? And with that, let's take a break.